Ladies and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of the largest and oldest wrestling family on the planet.
Listen to what I'm saying. That's right. Bring that camera in here a little bit closer.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the stud is here.
Hey, everybody. Welcome in. It's David Summers, and here comes another Studcast with the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. It's the story of wrestling in America as told by the Tennessee Stud, whose family started the profession over 100 years ago. So now, let's step back into the ring, back into time. Let's get wall-to-wall tree top tall with the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. Hey, Ron, I saw a classic photo. I have to assume, I know you were in Charlotte over the weekend and hooked up with your brother, but you brothers hooked up with two other brothers, and I thought, man, what a pick is this? The two Fuller brothers and the two Rougeau brothers. How cool was that? It was an awesome pick of you guys.
Yeah, man, they were the last two guys I thought we'd see in Charlotte, you know, all the way down from Canada. They had a lot of big long line too, like we did for all kinds of pictures with people. And those convention deals like this is pretty amazing, man, at how many people come through there and what they're looking for. You find people carrying around belts and all these things that they have, they want you to sign. It's quite an event, those things. Been doing quite a few of them, and they're all enjoyable. Got to see a whole lot of guys I never get to see.
That is awesome. So Robert's doing well.
Yep, he's doing great. Doing great. He went home to a hurricane.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But I assume he had no problems with that.
Oh, no, he just did a little big flooding. That was kind of a strange hurricane, right? I mean, it didn't have a lot of wind in it, but it sure had a tremendous amount of rain.
Yeah, Johnny Cash saying, how deep is the water, Mama? 5 feet high and rising. So hopefully he's doing well. And so you guys got to spend a few minutes with Jacques and Ramon, the Rougeau brothers, and the picture. Again, it was on Robert's page, but Robert Fuller's page, but you're going to try to get that pic on your page also.
Yeah, probably pick that up from him and run it too. We took that at the very end, just before we actually left, all four of us. So
I got to say again, you guys looked happy. You looked good, and I just thought, wow, that's the Fuller brothers. That's the
Rougeaus, yes, sir,
The Rougeau brothers.
Yeah.
Okay.
Famous dudes, those boys. Yeah.
Well, we kind of grew up with all you guys. Anyway, it slipped my mind for a second there. All right, listen, we got a big one today. It's kind of hard not to open this Studcast with the sad news about the passing of your good friend, Kevin Sullivan. I think any wrestling fan that ever saw him over an extended period of time will never forget him. And I got to say, he was one of the first wrestlers that I figured out, oh, that's Kevin Sullivan, as a kid. So he's really been around a long time.
Oh, yeah, man. A heck of a long time. About the same age as myself and Rob, you know, and
yeah.
I don't think there's any doubt about that, man, that they're never going to forget him. And he was a one-of-a-kind person, obviously, extremely respected, man, liked and admired by wrestling friends. He had so many wrestling friends, which is kind of unusual And there were, you know, there were a lot of them. And my thoughts and condolences go out to his family members. And I could probably do two or three studcasts about him. But I know that he'd be upset if I did that. You know, he was that kind of guy. So I am, however, going to pay a tribute to him on the end of this studcast.
I think that's cool. And a lot of people may not realize, and I maybe I didn't realize, he was only 5'9 and competed the way he did. I think that's amazing. And listen, Ron, I can understand that too, that we're all looking forward to the end of the studcast and to finding out more about your relationship with Kevin Sullivan. Last week's studcast, we'll move on in the meantime. Last week's studcast was another great one. So where are we going to be riding in this one?
Well, we're going to start out, man, with the last week of July, 1980. We'll be talking about both the territories, Tennessee and down on the Gulf Coast. We're going to start out in southeastern Tennessee. They were getting a cage match on their card down there. Sadly, with the news today, they had a Boston Street fight on this card. You know, what a coincidence, obviously, with the great Kevin Sullivan. And seems to be like he's everywhere now, doesn't it? I mean, he's so popular and been talked about so much.
Yeah.
We all miss him. We'll also be covering, man, the red-hot southeastern Gulf Coast territory. We're going to be doing that in much greater detail, obviously, than the Tennessee territory. And after three straight weeks of sellouts there, the Gulf Coast card was going to dramatically change. But by the time the TV show promoting the new card was over, fans were going to pour into the arenas again. It wasn't going to make a lot of difference. Business was really great down there. And this was going to be the last show during the July rating period. And maybe the best TV of the month on this one, with a Southeastern Tag Championship match between the champions, Rob and I, and a brand new team for Big C. He's come with two different guys in the last 2 weeks. Teams had to split up when they lost. Now he's put together Ron Bass and Randy Rose as the team to go after the belts. And I'll be giving everybody the results of the last card in July of 1980 and the attendances, as always, for the three main arenas. And then I'm going to end this studcast with my tribute to one of my best friends I ever had in wrestling, man. He passed last week, and talking about, obviously, the incomparable Kevin Sullivan.
As always, it's another loaded studcast. I don't know how we're going to get through this, but I'm sure we will. And we can't wait to hear your tribute to Kevin. I'm sure it's going to be one of a kind on the end of the show. So I think you said we would begin today in the southeastern Tennessee territory, which I think means the Knoxville area. That would be with the card. And let's go to Thursday, July 31st. 1980. So what can you tell us about that card?
Basically, as always, only what was advertised in the Knoxville newspaper. That's where I got this stuff from. And thank goodness my good friend Ed Harrison picks up these ads for me and sends them to me. And there were only four matches in the newspaper ad, so I really don't know how many matches they had totally. But hopefully, only Anderson, who was booking at the time for them, put at least six total matches, because I had recommended that to Jim Barnett and Fred Ward, the Georgia promoters that bought me out. I recommended that early on before I left in 1979. And this was the four matches that was in the newspaper. And the first of those four matches was Steve Kern versus a guy named Bruiser Bob Sweetan. Next of the advertised matches was the Southeastern Championship match, Tommy Rich versus Dennis Condrey. After that was going to be a Boston street fight, the specialty of Kevin Sullivan, who was from Boston, obviously, and he was facing Maniac Mark Lewin, and it was on Lewin's sixth appearance in Knoxville. And then in the main event, there was a steel cage match with the Assassins going up against Mr. Wrestling number two, and making his first appearance ever in Knoxville was Stan Hansen. Another great friend of mine.
All right, so how would you rate that card, Stud? What do you think?
Well, in the Kern and the Sweetan match, it was Sweetan it was Sweet Tan's first Tennessee match. And since I didn't really know him or anything about him, I can't imagine the Knoxville fans were going to know him either or go and consider buying a ticket to see him, you know. So that was not really the greatest. But, you know, he was in the territory. He hadn't been there. So they put him on the card. Then they had the Tommy Rich versus Dennis Condrey match. And the ad didn't say which of the two was the champion. And to me, that was a mistake. In my opinion, acknowledging the champion in those ads always made the match more interesting. And Tommy Rich had wrestled Harley Race the week before for the world title. Dennis Condrey had become a very good wrestler, period, at that period of time. And both of those competitors had been known in the territory for at least 3 years. They'd been there for a while, in and out, and mostly in that territory. And that was a very important fact, and I think probably that was the match of the night, Tommy Rich and Dennis Condrey for the Southeastern title. Then in the Kevin Sullivan match against Maniac Mark Lewin, which was a Boston street fight, it was Mark Lewin's sixth match in Knoxville, and only the third between these two guys. The first two were tag matches, and this was their first single match against each other. And kind of crazy, already it was a Boston street fight. So, you know, the Ole's booking was a little different than my booking and my brother's booking. And I think Kevin was over in Knoxville at that time, probably better than any baby face on this card. And I hope that they put him over because that was his type of match and it was his specialty. Then the cage match was the Assassins against Mr. Wrestling 2 and Stan Hansen. It was the fifth match between Mr. Wrestling 2 and some combination of the Assassins. And we've been talking about this in the last few studcasts about this particular series of matches between Wrestling 2 and the Assassins. And this was one that Wrestling 2 had a third partner out of the five straight matches in this strange series. You know, three of them were going to be tags, and this one was going to be in a steel cage. They're, like I said, brand new partner, and you know, so now you got a cage match with a guy that's never been in the ring with the Assassins. I really don't know what to say about this booking, except maybe what were you thinking, Ole?
All right, so that's a really interesting look at what was happening in Knoxville, Tennessee. The last day of July, 1980. So what about the attendance for this card on that particular night?
Well, the week before was that world title match with Tommy Rich versus Harley Race. The Georgia owners had one of their best crowds since taking over the company 9 months earlier. They had almost 3,000 in the Chilhowee Park Amphitheater. And it went back down again on this show because it's hard to follow a world championship night. Mm-hmm. And they dropped from 3,000 down to a little less than 2,000 fans. And that's back to where it basically was since they'd bought me out. You know, the territory had been dropping and dropping, and it was still in a kind of a free fall.
Wow, that's a cool summation and a really interesting assessment of what was happening in southeastern Tennessee. So now I think you want to take us southward. Let's go about 500 miles to the south. Southeastern Gulf Coast, I think, was a little bit more exciting than what was happening at the time in the decaying market of Knoxville. So how about the card? Set up the card for all three major markets along the Gulf Coast in that same last week of July of 1980.
Well, it was time basically to change the direction of the territory. There was a dramatic change in the card in southeastern Gulf Coast from what it had been for several weeks. At least 3 weeks there, the territory had sold out every night. And as a booker, this was an extremely critical time to get things going in a different direction. Yet you were trying to somewhat maintain the huge crowds. Pretty hard to do figuring out how to make that happen. And in Mobile, we were moving back into Expo Hall. And we were going to lose that additional 5,000 seats. The main arena was twice the size of Expo. And so it was a good time to make that happen because we were moving back into Expo. So we changed the direction of everything we were doing and had an entirely different card than what we had been having. And this night, it was six matches. And we had been occasionally having seven matches during that big 3-week period that we were coming off of. And the opening match on this card was going to be Charlie Cook versus the Avenger. And this was going to be then the last of the three-man matches between the junior heavyweights and the territory. And we were doing these three-man matches to see who was going to get the next shot at the United States Junior Heavyweight Championship belt. This three-man match was between Tony Charles, Ricky Gibson, and Norvell Austin. For the first time in these three-man matches, all three of these wrestlers were baby faces. So, wow, it's a different type of match, and all of them are baby faces. So that's right away, we're headed in a different direction with this card. Then the next match, for the first time ever, we're going to have the two biggest men in the territory going to face each other. Joe LeDuc was going to be wrestling Plowboy Frazier, and Plowboy was seconded by his buddy Floyd. Then for the United States Junior Heavyweight title, Jerry Stubbs was defending for the first time ever against Sweet Brown Sugar. And this is two heels against each other. So we've got a three-man with three baby faces against each other. Now a match with two heels against each other. So we're giving people a really different look at the wrestlers in the territory. In the fifth match of the night, Rob and I were scheduled to defend the Southeastern Tag Belts against Big C's new team, Ron Bass and Randy Rose. The main event was the only match returning from last week's card, and that was Bob Armstrong, Southeastern champion, was defending against the Mongolian Stomper, managed by Big C. And this was going to be Stomper's last chance to win the belt. If he didn't win it, he wasn't going to get another try for it.
That's a pretty interesting card right there, no doubt about it. A heel versus heel match. Three baby faces against each other in a three-man match. Two championship matches with wrestlers that had never before even met each other. And the Stomper's last chance to win the Southeastern title from the late legendary Bob Armstrong. So it should be a very interesting TV show. How did you kick the TV show off?
Well, this one opened with Charlie Platt, and basically he explained to the fans what they were going to see in what was the last show of the month of July 1980 and the last show of that TV rating period. And in action was going to be Plowboy Frazier, Sweet Brown Sugar, Tony Charles, Rob and I were going to be defending Southeastern Tag Belts in the last TV championship match of the July rating period, and Bob Armstrong, the Big C, Mongolian Stomper were going to be involved in the personality profile.
Okay, so this TV, I mean, really had a little bit of everything in it. Who was up first on the TV show?
Well, Plowboy, and he was seconded by his little buddy Floyd, and both of them wore the overalls, And obviously it didn't look much alike because Plowboy was about three times the size of Floyd. But Joe LeDuc joined Charlie at the set, and he got a tumultuous response, naturally, from the TV crowd. Joe was really over, and his face was showing the effects, man, of that double bull rope match that we had the week before. But he was in a good mood. He was enjoying himself on this TV show. Plowboy was introduced first for this opening match, and he had a very competitive opponent for the match. He was going to be wrestling Charlie Cook, who was a great wrestler. So Joe got off to a good start. Right away, he started describing the upcoming match with Plowboy as wrestling someone as big as Andre. He said, wrestling a guy like him is going to be like wrestling Andre. Except, he said, Andre didn't have a valet like Floyd. So Rob and I were watching the dressing room monitor. We broke up on that one, and I'm sure the fans at home did also. So Charlie Cook displayed some skills right off the bat. He could really wrestle, man. And Plowboy wasn't the greatest wrestler. And as LeDuc continued with his commentary, you know, and he said something about Plowboy's overalls. He said, with his overalls on, he looks like he should be the mule pulling the plow rather than the one doing it. So Charlie kind of got a kick out of that when he had to laugh a little bit of that. And meanwhile, in the ring, Charlie Cook was still impressive, man, in spite of the fact he was giving up more than 200 pounds to his opponent. My boy was a monster.
Wow.
So Joe continued having a good time asking Charlie. He said, if you'd ever seen Floyd, Charlie, since he's been here, have you ever seen Floyd over there do anything but stand in Plowboy's corner? So as soon as these words back cleared his mouth, Floyd reached in the ring and he pulled Charlie Cook's legs out from under him. And Plowboy splashed Charlie, coming right off the ropes, man, put all of that 420 pounds on him, and he got the pin. So Joe LeDuc jumped up from the set, and he went straight to Plowboy, who had his back turned to Joe, and he was kind of celebrating Plowboy's win. He had helped him beat Charlie Cook. And so Joe snatched a little Plowboy up like he was a rag doll, and he dropped him down across his knee, and he commenced to put a whipping on his butt with his hand, and the studio crowd went crazy. Joe's decided now he's going to bust old Floyd's butt. So when Joe finished, he rolled him over off his knee, and he went straight to the dressing room. Plowboy got out of the ring, and he went over and grabbed his little buddy, and he came screaming to the set with Charlie, and he was saying, you know, Joe LeDuc, he said, he just made a big mistake putting his hands on Floyd. He said, he's going to have to pay for that next week. So and Floyd was standing there beside him, and he was crying like a baby, tears running down his face. So Charlie didn't know how to respond to this. Right? So, and he was laughing. He couldn't stop laughing. And he finally said, we'll be right back.
I can just see Charlie Platt doing that. What a great way to open a TV show right there. So I guess that was the first time anyone had put a hand on Floyd. All right, Ron, I tell you what, I think this is a good spot. Let's do our break right here because we've got a great second half, a big second half. And to repeat Charlie's words, we'll be right back when this Studcast continues. All right, Studcast fans, on this break, let's remind you, and it's something we don't talk about nearly enough, because these are legendary Super Studcasts that are posted, Ron, on your website, which is tnstud.com, tnstud.com. You did Super Studcasts, and you did 43 of these over time, and you're going to do your tribute here in a few minutes as we get into the second half of this current Studcast. But I think one that we need to really talk about, episode number 8, somewhere along in about 2019, in this one Studcast, this one is at least 3 hours long. You spent time with the legendary Honky Tonk Man and then the late, great Kevin Sullivan. Literally an hour and a half with Honky Tonk Man, another hour and a half with Kevin Sullivan. Tell us about this. And you were actually talking live with each of them at the time. Tell us about the time spent on this Studcast with the late Kevin Sullivan.
Wow, this was a tremendous Super Studcast. I mean, I talked to all types of different wrestlers in these 43, and what a great series. I'm really proud of these Super Studcasts. And Honky Tonk, I think, went first, and we talked for an hour and a half, and then I did Kevin for an hour and a half. And Kevin was great. I mean, Kevin had such a great personality. And, and I'm glad you brought this up. This is a really good subject here, because fans aren't going to have a lot of opportunity to hear something like this. And, it's only $2.99 for 3 hours. And, I don't think there's any better any better product in wrestling than what these Super Stud Casts were.
You know what? When we lose a great one like this, we all tend to gravitate towards our computers, and we want to know more about them. So if you're about to take a road trip, this could be one of the best hour and a halfs that you spend. Yeah, obviously, you could learn about Honky Tonk Man, and then right after that, it's another hour and a half with the late legendary Kevin Sullivan. And it's his words. You're interviewing him. So, and again, you did these live, and they're on tnstud.com. So you drop $299. You can stay on the road for a while, learn a lot about Kevin Sullivan.
Worth every penny, man, for 3 hours. And you'll never hear 3 hours of better entertainment than this.
You got to check it out. TNstud.com. $2.99. You gotta check it out. All right, Studcast fans, welcome back in. It's episode number 361. And when you're talking weekly, that's a lot of weeks that the Tennessee Stud Ron Fuller has given his time and his life to put these together to bring these incredible memories back. So episode number 361, it's called Changing Direction and Kevin's Tribute. So let's get going with the second half, Stud. And thanks, everybody, for being with us today. When we finish with the rest of our normal Studcast, it will be a time for the Stud and the tribute to his great friend, Kevin Sullivan, as we've been talking about today. So who was involved? Let's start with the second segment of the TV show. And who was involved on Saturday, July 26th, 1980, down south?
Well, it was the United States Junior Heavyweight Champion, and that was none other than Jerry Stubbs. And he was joining Charlie at the set, and he was going to watch his upcoming challenger, who was another great wrestler named Sweet Brown Sugar. And he had never wrestled Brown Sugar before. And Brown Sugar wasted no time in giving Stubbs an eyeful because he was actually in the ring. And he destroyed his opponent, man. And being a heel, kind of like Stubbs, at the end of it, he had beat his guy down so badly, he didn't need to do anything but just to basically cover him. But he reached down and he pulled up his tights when it wasn't necessary. I guess just to let Stubbs know that you're going to be wrestling a different style guy this coming championship match. So, and I don't know what the fans thought about it, but when they saw this match on the card, you know, they probably went, what kind of match is this going to be? But I'll tell you, after they watched it, they're going to be so impressed, more impressed than ever with Sweet Brown Sugar. He was a heck of a wrestler, and wow, so was Jerry Stubbs.
You know, I thought I did not remember him, but I do remember him well. He could wrestle either style exactly like Stubbs could. So I bet that really was a great match the following week. So here we are again at the personality profile. They've been really amazingly strong in the last few TV shows. So who was on this personality profile?
Well, man, the fan favorite, Southeastern Heavyweight Champion Bob Armstrong was on it. And he, like Joe LeDuc, was also showing the effects of a double bull rope match from the week before. And he had a patched up eye. He came on. So, you know, there's a couple of guys that's already showed up here showing the results of, wow, a wicked event, man, the double bull rope match. And on the profile set with his belt, he was ready to obviously enter the ring against the Mongolian Stomper. It was going to be his fifth title defense against the Stomper in the last 6 weeks. And there was a special stipulation in this upcoming match. If the Mongolian Stomper didn't win this time, it was going to be his last try at the Southeastern Championship. So Charlie Platt welcomed him, Bob, we're talking about, and boy, so did the studio crowd. And in their own special way, they gave him a standing ovation, actually, when they saw him coming to the set, because they loved him, man. And Charlie told him, you know, he was going to be talking to him right after, showing him some comments about the big C had made earlier in the day. So right away they cut away to an interview, basically, that was done earlier in the day with Big C. And as the first thing everybody noticed was the third wrestler on this TV show that had suffered an injury from the double bull rope match. And so we're talking about the Stomper here. He had a head injury, obviously, too. But it wasn't affecting him any because he had that old truck shock out there, and he was pumping that thing. It wasn't distracting him at all. So the Big C was upset, as always. He's always complaining about something, and this time he was complaining about what had happened in last week's Southeastern Tag Championship match, where me and Rob, they call us the Fuller Punks. That was his little nickname for us.
The Fuller Punks?
Punks, yeah, the two Fuller Punks. And he said it was the second week in a row his partners had lost another one of those crazy losing tag team, had to split forever matches. And basically, he said it was his partners had lost. And he had to point out the fact that he didn't get beat, that the guy he was partnering with got beat, and that he couldn't wrestle with them anymore as partners. And now he said, for whatever reason, he had no idea what's going on here with Southeastern Commissioner Don Curtis, because he forced him to sign a contract this was going to be Stomper's last shot at Bob Armstrong's Southeastern title. And then, because he had been having a little problem with Charlie, and he said, and I better not find out that idea came from Charlie Platt. So Charlie was watching this. I'm sure he wasn't expecting that to be thrown in. So, Don went on. I mean, our boy, he just couldn't stop himself. And he said, just like that, losing teams split matches, they come out of nowhere. Where did they come up? Who came up with this idea that when the team lost, that the team had to split up? And said, now it's the first time, we've lost a belt match, and what's going on at Southeastern? He was just bumping off the wall, man, with all of his comments. And he said, don't mess with the Big C, Don Curtis. he really shouldn't have said that. And he said, I may own both of your championships. And the studio crowd reaction was to that statement. So then he continued again saying, but this new match, this last shot match, is not going to end the way everybody wants it to. He said, my Stomper's going to win that belt back. And then he goes, I'm going to demand a last shot title match with Armstrong. And I want to be done with Bob Armstrong forever. So he finished by inviting Ron Bass and Randy Rose out. And then he challenged us in the upcoming tag match. We are having a tag match on the end of the show, a championship tag match with Rose and Bass. And so he invites them out, and he says he wanted to, I have a challenge for the Fuller Punks. And he goes, I'd like to see this match that we're about to have, tag match, be a tornado tag match. Have all four men in the ring at the same time. And he says that then the winning fall could take place any place inside or outside the ring. In other words, you could win the fall by beating guy out on the floor. Yeah. So when it came back to Bob, he was more than ready to respond. I mean, everybody got pretty quickly tired of hearing from the Big C. And as soon as the interview ended, he told fans, he said, talk is cheap, he said, especially when it's coming out of the Big C's mouth. And he said, nothing makes him more proud than being the fans' champion. And he said, if he could, he was going to be their champion forever. And he got up, holding the belt over his head, and he returned to the dressing room. And the studio crowd gave him a standing ovation again, just like they did when he came in. So, then Charlie was about to close the profile. And Rob and I, we had watched this little thing, and, we saw what the challenge that the Big C had made. So we went to the set. I said, Rob, let's get our belts and go to the set, man. And so we passed Bob going back to the dressing room. We were going to the set. And so we stopped Charlie from closing out the profile and said, "Well, Charlie, we want to accept the Big C's challenge that they made a few minutes ago for a tornado tag match, all four of us in the ring. And, you know, and the winning fall could be could take place inside or outside the ring." And then we added, as far as I'm concerned, I said, we'll take a pinfall anywhere in the building. You know, we'll beat him on the second floor if we want to up there, if we can fight up there, right? So they closed the profile, obviously, with a pretty big pop.
Oh, no doubt about that. I'm sure the studio crowd was digging that big time. All right, so it was another great personality profile. So who is in the next TV match?
Well, Tony Charles was in the ring. And the other two wrestlers, Ricky Gibson and Norvell Austin, they were going to be in this upcoming three-man match with him. So they sat down with Charlie, one on each side of Charlie. They're both baby faces at the set. Then they were going to make some comments about Tony's match. But Tony didn't give long to talk, man. I mean, you could tell, man, Tony had gone 3 weeks at this point in these three-man matches, and he had not won a single one of them. So he had had no opportunity to get a shot to win his belt back from Jerry Stubbs. So I think he took this match as his opportunity to let people see where his mind was. And, boy, he took that fact out on his poor opponent. In fact, he ended the match with one of the highest throws. He did these crazy throws, man, the English style. And he did one that I had never seen him do in this. And I never seen him throw a guy as high as he did this guy either. It was like, wow. You know, almost the feet hit the lights in the studio. And and both Gibson and Austin, they're sitting there about to make some comments. And, wow, they were blown away. They were like, oh, my gosh. Wow. They were thinking, I'm sure, I hope he don't do that to me.
I get a giggle every time you say throws, because typically we would say a move or something like that. But Tony Charles used the phrase, that was a great throw. So anyway, it had to be time for you and Robert, the Punks, to defend.
Yeah.
I mean, that's crazy. You're 6'9", Robert's 6'4", something like that, right?
Yeah,
6'5". Yeah, and 6'5", and they refer to you as Punks. Okay. So it had to be time to defend your Southeastern tag belts against Big C's brand new team, Ron Bass and Randy Rose. How big was Ron Bass? How tall was he?
Ron Bass was about 6'5".
Wow. Okay.
Probably 320 maybe.
Yeah, he was wide. Yeah. Wow.
He was over three, and he was a big boy.
No doubt. Wow.
So, yeah, it was Ron Bass was one of the four men on this TV and the fourth guy. Ron Bass was patched up, too, and he had a cut on his forehead, and he had a black eye to boot. He was one of the – he had more than the other three, you know, but he had been in that double bull rope. So it says everything about what the double bull rope match was all about. You know, they all looked like they'd been in car accidents. And he had not only that patch on his forehead, but like I said, he had a black eye too. So the Big C was standing at ringside. Well, you know, he's going to manage them. And when the bell rang and all four of us, man, we tore into each other. This is going to be a tornado match. You're not going to tag you in or out. And the studio went crazy, man. We fought inside. We fought outside the ring. The match went almost 15 minutes. Which was, man, like an eternity in a television match, because you got those bright lights, and it was exhausting if you were a wrestler and you were trying to deal with the lights and everything else, and especially in one of these matches where you couldn't tag in or out. Everybody was going full steam for 15 minutes. And there were at least, I'd say, 15 pins that guys kicked out of. You know, and Robert was busted open. He was bleeding in this match. Ron Bass cut that he had opened up, and he was bleeding. And so finally, with time running out on the on the on the end of the show, I had Bass in the corner, and I was just got up on the rope, second rope, and I was kind of rifling him with some punches, man. And the referee was with us. Out on the floor was Rose and Robert. Rose and Rob grab Rob and a full Nelson, and here comes Big C. He loads his glove. Referee's with me. You can't see what's going on out there. And when he went to knock Rob out, Rob ducked, and Big C knocked Randy Rose out. So Rob went after Big C.
Wow.
And he got him down, and he was tearing into him, and the ref was still trying to pull me off of Bass. And suddenly out of the Heels dressing room, the door opened up, and here came, man, Mongolian Stomper. And Rob had his back turned to him, and he never saw him coming. But Rob's kind of on top of Big C, pounding him, and Stomper kicked him in the back of the head, and then he went over and put Rose on top of Rob, and he drug Big C back into the dressing room. And the referee finally got me off of Bass about that time, and he saw Rose on top of Rob outside the ring on the floor, and he climbed out of the ring, and I started to go out to try to get to Rose to keep the match going, and Bass grabbed me around the legs, and he held on to me, man, for dear life, and the referee counted Rob out. So about a minute before, this was about a minute before the actual TV time on the show ran out. So Bass let my legs go, and he rolled out of the ring. He went straight to the referee, and he got his hand raised, and then he went over, to the set, Charlie's desk, because our belts were sitting on that desk, and he grabbed the belts and he raised them in the air, and Charlie had no time left. Said, "Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. See you next week." Basically,
wow. That's how you close a show right there. I mean, but because I'm pretty sure I was included. I'm sitting on the edge going, well, no, it's not going off. But I bet you guys were dead tired, and probably the studio crowd as well. So what happened the next week in the arenas for the big shows, the live shows?
Well, Charlie Cook beat the Avenger. Norvell Austin won the three-man match, and he got the next opportunity to face the United States Junior Heavyweight Champion the next week. Joe LeDuc and Flyboy Frazier both got disqualified. There was no winner in that match. Jerry Stubbs defended successfully the Southeastern United States Junior Heavyweight belt against Sweet Brown Sugar. Ron Bass and Randy Rose, they had become the Southeastern champions on TV just days before. So we were scheduled to defend against them. We were going to be champions, and we had lost the belts. So that gave us the opportunity to automatically get a return match for the belts. So it was a championship match, and instead of us defending against them, they were the champions and had to defend against us. Big C got his team disqualified on purpose to keep them from losing the belts. We were about to beat them, and Big C got them disqualified. So, Big C completed his biggest week ever in Southeastern in the next match because his Mongolian Stomper beat Bob Armstrong. So basically, Big C in less than a week had won both the tag and the Southeastern single belts.
Wow.
Both in less than a week.
Wow. Hard to believe, Ron. No doubt he had a hand in beating Bob Armstrong.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, Yeah, obviously. That was pretty obvious, you know, and they definitely had a hand in the Mongols match. And we'll talk about that one next week. The attendances, let's get to the attendances for the week. They held up remarkably well, considering that, you had a double bull rope and 3 weeks of sellouts. Both Montgomery and Dothan, they fell below that 5,000 level where they'd been for about 3 weeks, but it was still around 4,500 people in both of those cities. And obviously Mobile had a bigger drop because we weren't in the big building like we had been the week before.
Mm-hmm.
But we still managed to sell out the Expo Hall with over 5,600.
5,600. Gotcha. Okay. To me, that's one of my favorite segments. No matter who's wrestling, I always love to hear what happened in Montgomery, in Dothan, in Mobile. I think that's really cool. Okay, Ron, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it is time for what many of us have been waiting for with the passing of the late, great Kevin Sullivan this week. So I think it's time for your tribute to Kevin Sullivan, and you can take us home with that.
Okay. Geez, I tell you, Dave, I hardly know where to begin, man. I met Kevin Sullivan 52 years ago.
Wow.
On a Monday night, November the 30th, 1972, in the Babyface dressing room, West Palm Beach Auditorium. And I saw somewhere the other day somebody put that card into on the social media site. And then they put it there because of what had happened with Kevin. And they said that this was Kevin's first ever match in Florida. And I got to thinking about it, and I kind of remembered how things went when we met Kevin that night. And my brother and I, we were wrestling in one of our first main events ever in the state of Florida against Sputnik Monroe, Norvell Austin, and a Texas Tornado death match. So it was Kevin's very first match in the Florida territory. He was only 1 year younger than I was, actually, and the same age as my brother. And his Boston accent was so strong, I remember, I could hardly understand anything he was saying to us. You know, and his first question to me was, he asked me, he says, Ronald, he always called me Ronald. He said, Ronald, he goes, how is it that you and Rob are wrestling in the main event and then you can't be much older than I am? You know, what's going on here, you know? So, and that kind of began my first conversation with Kevin Sullivan. We talked a little bit about our family background. And it's one of the hundreds of conversations that we had, man, over my 52 years of friendship with him. And we were going to have an on and off relationship like many wrestlers did, because back in those days, everybody wrestled everywhere and they went to different countries. And you might not see a friend for years because they're wrestling in other parts of the country or other parts of the world. So it was going to be a long time before I saw him again. I watched his first Florida match that night, and I could see that he was very green, and kind of like Rob and I were, you know. I mean, obviously, it was obvious that he was just starting, but I could also see that he was going to be a force in the business someday. I mean, he really had talent. But I had no idea he would become one of my closest friends in the business. When I left the Florida territory 2 years later, went to North to Knoxville to start my own wrestling company in Tennessee. But he was still there. He was teaming with Mike Graham, and they were soon after I left going to become the Florida Tag Team Champions. And Kevin was off and running, man, on his career. I didn't see him again for 4 years. Most of which he spent in Florida. And like me as a young wrestler, he made his first trip to Australia early in his career. Actually went there in the crew before I went there, and was part of a crew that was, wow, crazy. I mean, the crew he met, that's where he met the same Mark Lewin, my maniac Mark Lewin, that we talked about earlier, that he's going to be wrestling in the Boston street fight in the Knoxville card. And he also met a guy named King Curtis Ikea in that crew. So many great stars in that crew, but a lot of kind of unsavory characters, man, and guys that were going to influence him in his career later on during his best years, which were going to be years that he was in Florida. So he's the only person I ever knew, man, that always called me Ron. And in 1978, he called me and he said, Ronald, you know, he says, can I come and work for you in Knoxville? Well, I'd been there for more than 3 years at that point, and my territory was on fire. We had struggled for 2 years, and we got it kicked off big time, 77 by 78. We were doing good. And obviously, I said, yeah, absolutely, Kevin, you know. So he quickly became a top star, and like overnight. Fans fell in love with him, and he absolutely fell in love with Tennessee. He just went. And he was a part of the crew there when the Knoxville War started in 1979. And I never had to ask what side he was going to be on. I'll tell you that. I knew without a doubt that Kevin was going to stay and support me until that war was all over, and he did. When I sold out in 1979, he wanted to go to Pensacola with me. But the Georgia promoters that had bought me out, I gave them the opportunity. I said, pick four guys out of this crew and you can have them, you know. And it turned out that Kevin happened to be one of the four guys they wanted to stay, you know. So I asked him, you know, if he would help me out, and he would go ahead and stay with them, and he could come to later on to Pensacola with me, and so we didn't work together after that. They kept him. Not only did they keep him in Georgia, they sent him back to Florida, and we didn't work together again for 6 years, but constantly we stayed in touch all those years. He spent most of them in the early, mid-1980s back in the Florida territory. For the first time in his career, he was a heel. And my gosh, he was a great one, I'll tell you. And it was one of his biggest runs in wrestling, I'm sure, as a matter of fact. He became one of the wildest personas ever in the sport during his time. He became a satanic and occultish field wrestler and manager. And he wore his devilish makeup. And everywhere he went, he set the Florida territory on fire. He would wear his makeup and his outfits to go to the grocery store. I mean, he lived his gimmick. I mean, he loved it. He went nuts over and wow, I'm not so sure he wasn't pretty much where he was acting like he was at this point. And then out of nowhere in 1986, he called me up and he wanted to know if he could. I think the way he put it is, Ronald, can I come home? And he said, you know, he wanted to wrestle and manage. He'd heard about how we were doing with Continental Championship Wrestling at that point. It had become a big company, and he had a team. He said, I've got a team. And God knows where he found these guys, but it was certainly a unique team that he had. It was a far-out gimmick, but it was nowhere near as crazy as what he was doing in Florida there during the mid-80s with managing guys down there in that territory. So he called his team the New Guinea Headhunters. And my gosh, man, they were as wild as their name. I can tell you that. They each one weighed about 300 pounds. They had their faces painted. They wore these New Guinea outfits. They had these real grass sheets that went from their knees down to their bare feet. They wrestled in bare feet. And they would come to the ring carrying these lit tiki torches with them, and behind them would be Kevin in this long black hooded robe, painted face. He was the little Satan. That's what I used to call him. You know, and so we both loved his gimmick. I mean, and we worked together on ideas for his team, and we came up with one of the best angles that I think was ever done, no doubt, in the business. His two headhunters were the Continental Tag Champions on and off for many months, working mostly against Rob and I, but also they worked against Bob Armstrong and his sons. So to stop Kevin from interfering, which he was doing in every match, basically, and to give us a chance to get our hands on the tag belts, which me and Rob couldn't get back, Rob and I demanded we have a championship cage match with his team. And he agreed, which really should have said a lot to me and Rob when he said, yeah, we'll do that. You know, so in that cage match, which was being televised from Boutwell Auditorium, Birmingham, Alabama, on this night that we had the cage match, we had 8,000 people in Boutwell Auditorium. They were screaming like crazy, and Rob and I were kicking butt. We were taking care of his boys, and then all of a sudden, a huge knife blade came up from underneath the ring, up through the mat. And then if you had happened to be there where the blade went, I guess you might have gotten killed, you know.
Wow.
But the blade came up through the mat, and then the blade cut through the mat across the ring. And suddenly these 8,000 fans that were going crazy, they went totally silent. The building went from standing up screaming to nobody saying anything. They watched, all of them with their mouths open. And then one big piece of plywood came out of the mat where the cut had been, and was shoved up through the hole. And out came a third head up. There'd never been a third head up. Nobody'd seen this guy before. Wow. And he was the biggest one of all. Hmm. I mean, this guy was a monster. So then they took the key to the lock. They were on the cage door, away from the referee. They opened up the door. They threw the referee out of the cage. Kevin came into the cage, and they locked the door back. And now there was four of them on us. And, boy, they left Rob and I bloody, man, and beat to pieces. And then they went to Gordon Solie on the set to celebrate their victory, man, because this was all on television. So, At a time when almost every wrestling territory in the country and the world was kind of disappearing, 1986, things were not going good for wrestling promotions, and Continental, after this angle, exploded in popularity. We sold out everywhere for months and months, and Kevin stayed with me until I sold the company to television station owner in Montgomery, Alabama, in late 1987. So less than 3 years later, I was in the hockey business. I got out of wrestling entirely. I got into hockey, and Kevin got himself a spot, a great spot with WCW, which was Ted Turner's World Championship Wrestling Company in Atlanta. And he later became the booker in that territory, and a pretty darn good one, too. So we didn't see each other until 1994. I had sold my second hockey team, and I'd retired in the Florida Keys. And so he calls me up one day out of the clear blue. I mean, you know, I hadn't heard from him in a long time, maybe years. And he asked, during the conversation, he asked me, well, where do you live now? And I told him, man, I live in Tavernier in the Florida Keys. He said, Ronald, he goes, I live in Key Largo. He said, we're only 10 miles apart.
Wow.
And we'd been 10 miles apart for a year and never knew it, right? So we kind of began our relationship over again. We both had boats, and we got together regularly. And every week he came back from WCW and from Atlanta. And when he did, he would come to see me, or I would go to see him. And as I kind of finish this tribute, I got a quick little story about him. And often, I guess I got to call it a playful personality. I mean, he was a rare dude. We were diving on a lobster reef one day, and I'd caught a lobster, and I was headed back to the boat. And he grabbed a little 2-foot-long hammerhead shark by the tail. Because you were in lobster hold, you would get down in the coral, and there was a little hammerhead in there. And I could see him catch the shark, right? And I'm swimming back to put my lobster in the boat. And he screams at me. He goes, "Ronald, shark!" And when I turned to look at him, he threw a little shark at me. It hit me in the head.
Oh, my God.
And he started laughing. Well, we both had a big laugh out of it, but that was his shark joke. So for those men that may not know, you know, how he died, and I didn't myself until I found out this information. I didn't even realize that he was almost my age. He was 74 years old, and he had badly injured his leg. He developed a blood clot in his leg, and then he got an infection from that blood clot. And then finally, he got sepsis, which is a very serious condition in which the body occasionally responds with an extreme reaction to an infection. And the sepsis killed him. That's how he died. You know, Kevin was a unique human being. He was different in every way than a normal person. Those that knew him, I know for sure, will never forget him, including maybe millions that saw him wrestle, because he wrestled for WCW. He went on to wrestle for WWE. Mm. He was a star. And I'm going to miss him, man. I'm going to miss him as much as I do Bob Armstrong.
Wow.
And just like Bob, there's never going to be another Kevin Sullivan.
Wow, Ron, what a great tribute to one of the best wrestlers in history. As I mentioned earlier, and it just pales in comparison to everything that you just said about Kevin Sullivan. But as a kid, he was one of the first names that I knew in wrestling. And as always, this has been another wonderful Studcast filled with history and fascinating stories. So I guess the next question is, where do we ride on the next one?
Well, we're going to be returning to Tennessee for another card in Knoxville, and we'll be moving into the month of August in 1980. Kevin was on the main event in this next event we're going to be talking about in Knoxville, and we're going to discuss things that were happening there that were adversely affecting their business, which we've kind of been talking about every week a little bit. And all of this is going to ultimately lead to the future owners of Southeastern being Ric Flair and Blackjack Mulligan. They're going to change the name, but those are the two guys that's going to end up owning that. So, then we're going to ride south into the red hot Southeastern Gulf Coast territory. We're going to do some more booking, discover the next card. We'll talk about the TV to promote that card, the results of the matches, the attendances. And we'll take a look at what was coming with the addition soon at this point of Birmingham, which is the largest city in the state of Alabama. And it's going to become the future home of Continental Championship Wrestling. And then hopefully after all that, maybe we'll have time for me to answer another Learning Tree question.
All right, good deal. Looking forward to that, as always. Hey, folks, you know the deal. You know how to contact The Stud on social media. He's everywhere on Facebook. Find Ron at Ron Fuller, The Tennessee Stud. Like and follow him there. Automatically become friends with a living legend. On Twitter, also known as X, you can find him at Ron Fuller Welch. You can follow him there also. Check out the fantastic website we talked about earlier, tnstud.com, and the Super Studcast, episode number 8. Is the one we were talking about earlier. This Studcast is going to be there. Every Studcast ever done. The Stud Store is where you can get, as we've been saying, 43 Super Studcasts. The Kevin Sullivan version is number 8 at tnstud.com under Super Studcast. You'll see the heading at the top of the page. 4 different 8x10 photos. The best-selling novel, Brutus, personally autographed to you. Ron can make that happen. You can also subscribe to his YouTube channel, Southeastern Rewind. Find hundreds of hours of classic old school wrestling entertainment, 436 total videos, the last 139 Studcasts, Ask the Stud shows, and Short Rides with the Stud. Go back 1 year or more, discover fantastic stud stories with worldwide stars, Studcast archive stories, Tell Me More fan question shows, superstars of the past shows, and so much more. That's YouTube Southeastern Rewind. It's the best deal in wrestling. All right, any final comments from you, Stud?
Well, to everybody, thanks for joining us today. Hope you enjoyed the tribute to Kevin, and please pray for his family. All of us out there will be thinking about them. And for those that don't normally listen, I hope you come back for other Studcasts. And as always, please take care of yourselves and others, and may God bless us all.
For Ron Fuller in the Great Smoky Mountains of Tennessee, I'm David Summers saying thank you for listening. Find me at davidsummersproductions@gmail.com. This Studcast is a David Summers production for Tennessee Stud, LLC.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So fool Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud. This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains.